Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm good. You would think I would learn.
Learn from what?
I've this is not our first podcast together. I don't know how many we've done together, but it's a lot. And I just had a quick bite of an ice cream sandwich, and now I'm having trouble talking.
Chuck, you have to take care of yourself. I mean, you're the talent here. You're the one carrying this dynamic duo, to start them.
Well, that's true. That's true. I do a lot of vocal cord workouts. I hope you're doing the same, just to really maximize what we got going on.
Yeah, I think that's what people are tuning in for, the timbre of your voice, Chuck. They just want you to not choke on yourself as you're recording the podcast.
My voice, I've been told, is good for one thing, falling asleep too. So I think that's a skill set I have, putting people to sleep.
Yeah, the skill set I had recently is that when I traveled up to Rochester to visit our friends at Mayo, they allowed me to pick the articles for the Peripheral Nerve Journal Club. So I picked articles based on the locations that I traveled, and I won't say where the article was from, but one of the articles had the dubious distinction of putting Dr. Spinner to sleep. So that was, he questioned the veracity of the article and said it was good because it was the last thing I read before I went to bed.
Hey, it happens. You know what? It happens.
Can't win them all.
No, for sure not. So catch me up. You've traveling. You recently went to Rochester. You're clinically busy. Are you hanging in there?
Yeah, we talked last week about the adding on the clinic, and the more I think about it, the more I'm regretting doing it. I did the same thing for next week. So we're going out of town on Friday, and I put a little half day guy on Wednesday because I was like, you know what, might as well. And now I'm like, I really could have used that time. I think I mentioned it last week, the hand therapist I work with, Jamie Findice, she was like, yeah, remember when you just used to like take a day off and not try to make up for it? It's like, long time ago.
Well, if this makes you feel any better, I still haven't learned. It's this constant, I don't know why, but I enjoy clinical care, but I'm always adding clinics like you just did. And I still regret it after it's done. And then the next time, guess what? I do it again.
Yeah, I think the listeners are seeing our pathology, and I wonder where I learned this pathology. Who did I train with that may model this behavior?
I wonder if our listeners have the same pathology, or if they are, they just do a better job than we did.
I think our overseas listeners are saying, why can't you Americans just take your holiday and enjoy it? I really need to, for sure. I've definitely craved a self-care day, for sure.
Yeah, I could see you in the spa with your feet up getting a massage on your self-care day.
Not above it, man. Not above it. I wish I had that. I'm not above admitting that. As I've aged, Chuck, as you remind me, I am totally okay with owning myself and who I am. So it's out there on the pod. I wouldn't mind that, for sure.
Absolutely. So if anyone's looking to get Chris a gift, you know what it could be.
Oh, man. So we've gotten some really cool emails. We're going to go into a few of them again today, just like we did last week. But I did want to share a nice email. So this is from Brad Hyatt. He's an orthopedic hand surgeon practicing about 5 years now. Little pup compared to me and Chuck, I guess. And he said that it was with special interest that he listened to our latest episode the day before he had actually undergone a carpal tunnel release himself, wide awake by one of his trusted colleagues, and everything went smoothly. But of course, he was probably thinking of our episode, and he mentioned here, he wanted us to share our thoughts on the cause of the nerve injury. So, he said one of the least favorite parts of an open or mini open carpal tunnel is the controlled glide to release the proximal aspect of the TCL, distal volar and brachial fascia. And all the technique articles describe this as being under direct visualization. Now, there are times where this glide is not directly visualized, and I have occasionally extended the incision proximally, but dislike the prolonged healing and wider scar when crossing the wrist crease. So do I. I've been tempted to perform a scissor glide without 100% visualization. This can seem so routine and seem safe, yet the consequences of an error can be catastrophic. I can't help but wonder if this is what happened in the case you presented. I'm interested to hear your thoughts and any tips or tricks for the proximal release. Chuck, what do you think about the slide? I remember what you told me when I was your fellow, and I'm going to allow you to answer first, and I'll recant the recall, what you told me.
Recall so I can recant.
Exactly.
Well, first of all, thank you, Brad. And it's not a good time to listen to that episode, I guess, right before one has his own carpal tunnel released.
Right after.
Oh, right after. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a couple of thoughts. Distally, I don't think anyone tries to slide or glide with scissors. It doesn't work. It's about careful visualization. And I've always been told that the most common injury is to the sensory branch to the third web space. I've not seen that in the median nerve complications. I have seen it, but it's not the most common that I've encountered as a surgeon caring for the complications of others. My more common scenario is a direct injury to the nerve itself. And some certainly are related to sliding. I'll say this. I think we should always try to visualize what we're doing. But I have, on occasion, slid my scissors proximally without full visualization. I'll say this, though. I do it very carefully with aware of where the median nerve is and the palmar cutaneous branch is, also aware of where the ulnar bundle is, and I carefully drop my hand as far as it can go so the tips of my scissors are really heading volarly rather than any other direction. So, A, am I wrong to do it that way on occasion, Chris? And B, do you?
So I remember what you told me because I had seen others do the slide in training at other places, and it always made me nervous. I remember you told me that it was okay depending on who was doing it, which I always found very interesting. And then the other thing that I remember you commenting on was the way in which the orientation of your curved tenotomies. So depending on how you put them, you can either have them curved towards the ulnar vascular bundle or towards the palmar cutaneous branch in the median nerve. Now, neither of those I want to endanger, but if I had to pick one, it's definitely going to be the palmar cutaneous branch. So even when I don't slide personally, but when I'm doing that part of the procedure, A, that's the part that I do, not the trainee. Of course, I'm there with them the entire time. But in terms of how we orient positioned on the table, I'm sitting in the direction where my right hand can use the tenotomies going proximally, and they're typically on the other side of the table because usually they're right-handed. And then I turn my tips towards the palmar cutaneous because you have to pick one. And I like exactly what you said about making sure that you're going more volar anterior than anything else. This is clearly one in which our colleagues that use endoscopic could say, well, you could just use the endoscope. And yeah, I get it. I mean, like, you know, that's part of the perks, right? But, you know, if you look at the literature, one of the biggest series on locations of incomplete release, and it actually typically is noted as distal, although in practice, I've noted it to be proximal. I have not noted it to be distal. So at least that's what's out there in terms of the literature.
Yeah, interesting. I agree with everything you said. I sit the same direction. I think the risk is greater proximally. And that's why I want to do that proximal cut slash slide. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. My technical pearl here is from Tom Kiefhaber in Cincinnati, which is to use one Ragnell and two Sens to really create a box proximally that gives you visualization so that the vast majority of times you can see. Now, you can use a larger retractor as well, but that usually works, and I do not cross the wrist crease. I mean, today I did a distal radius fracture with a carpal tunnel release because the patient had tingling, and I made a, quote, larger incision, and it was 2.5 centimeters. I just don't feel the need to make an even larger incision unless something's really, really, you know, out of sorts. So I think we see eye to eye on this one.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, having you guys train me in terms of the technique and the Kiefhaber box, I've actually modified how I use the Kiefhaber box. And I actually have started to use some baby Army Navies after I've gotten my sends in for some of those patients in which when you make the skin incision, some of that ulnar neurovascular protective fat starts to make its way into your incision. And I found it very nice to just use a little baby Army Navy to get that out of the way. So that's the only modification I made from what you taught me.
I think that modification is okay. I wouldn't go too crazy and do any more modifications. That would be sacrilege. all right.
So just a couple more things, and then we can dive into an interesting case. So here is an email from Alexander Krug. And Alexander Krug is in practice at Ortho Virginia, and he wrote some really, really nice things about the podcast. He said he's been binge listening since only hearing about it a few weeks ago, and this was in May. And he saved his sanity by putting it on while folding laundry as a Mother's Day gesture. Alexander, I hope you didn't injure yourself. And he also felt very guilty about not going to the Mary Stern Fellowship Jackson Hole meeting because he had just listened to the podcast where Chuck mentioned it many times. So he says from Grandpa Chuck, his words, "I've learned tons of great technical and management pearls that obviously relate due to similar fellowship training." And from young, inquisitive Chris, "I relate to the feelings not too distant when you're 5 years out and the patient's surgical victory seems so much sweeter and the complications much more personally devastating." Amen to that. Thank you. "And you're both great examples and ambassadors for our profession on this platform." Thank you. That is what keeps us going. So he mentioned an episode he just finished about the PIP fracture dislocations. And he passed on with his lessons from the Dynamic X-Fix that changed his practice dramatically. He used to never give local when he took off the X-Fix in the office. Then one patient pleaded, and I did. After I took it off, left the room and came back, and because she was numb, she was also able to demonstrate full active motion right in front of me. So now I do a digital block in 4 weeks from removing the pins every time, just for seeing the motion immediately where I went off, but also found it will break up the occasional flexor tendon adhesion that you can hear/feel. And that infrequent patient that can't fully bend after removing, a poor prognostic sign. Wishing continued success to you both, Alex Krug."
So Alex, thanks. And we missed you in Jackson, and hopefully there'll be another reunion, even though the good Dr. Stern will be retired. I'm guessing he will still host in the future. Chris could be invited as a special guest, given his longstanding podcast for the Hand Study. Who knows?
I'm just hoping that it's kind of like a Michael Jordan kind of situation, 23-45, but maybe no Wizards phase of that,
Maybe. So it's kind of humorous. So we had a discussion. I think it may have been at our Lindley and I's Indications, or maybe it was at the main Monday morning conference.
You're so popular that you can't even keep track of when you say things.
So many conferences. Now, I'm not going to say that I said it. It was said. It was said by some of our partners who enjoy putting on the finger X-Fix for PIP fracture dislocations that sometimes they feel you might as well just pin the joint because they never have motion when the fixture comes off. And that is a little different than what Alex has related. And the truth may lie somewhere in between. I've never, ever numbed a finger to take off the fixture, but that is a really solid pearl.
Yeah, and I'm totally going to do that next time I have to do that.
Yeah, I mean, some active motion, some passive motion, try to get some pull through to break up the adhesions, or else just be able to manipulate a bit.
Well, I mean, I think that I remember Marty telling a story about how, he would have to deal with some patients who had finger stiffness in his fellowship, and he would have to go do digital blocks every time the patient came in to help out with that. So, I mean, there's something there for sure.
Yeah, love it. We welcome all pearls. Email us, tweet at us, Instagram at us. I don't know if that's the word.
But let us know. Yeah, these pearls are great. And I think that it's a great way to share your knowledge with the listeners. I mean, listener stats have been great. We've got, about 2,000 downloads a week, and we're very, very excited about that. And that actually leads us to the crux of our episode today, a great case that was sent in all the way from Greece. And, Ioannis Lakanas, sorry for not mispronouncing that, but he did mention that thanking us for the time and effort to deliver what is probably the best medical podcast on the internet. Now, if you had not put that qualifier in, probably I would have been really, really happy, but I love it anyway.
We'll
He
take
said it
it.
has now become, exactly, we will absolutely take it. It has now become almost compulsory for my residents to listen to you guys on their Monday commute. So I'm going to change some, leave out some details here, just in, in terms of privacy and whatnot. But so we have a patient who is not exactly young, not exactly old, and is a non-smoker, and was in an accident, a car accident, a little under a year ago, and she had radial-sided wrist pain, and X-rays were negative. She was given a splint, a lot of back and forth, and then negative X-rays and a CT scan 6 months after injury. Didn't show any bony issues, and then eventually had an MRI that showed a proximal pole non-union with a very small fragment and an avascular proximal pole and has lots of pain. So what do you think about this case, Chuck? You're the carpus maven. So how do you start to think about this case? Is this something that has come your way along your many, many, many years?
Well, in many years, one sees many things, and so yes, I have seen my fair share of proximal pole non-unions with or without vascularity. It's a really interesting topic because I think there are some institutions and some physicians who absolutely feel it can only be treated one way, and there are other institutions that have I was going to say diabolically, but I guess I should say diametrically opposed point of view. So to be very
Or
clear,
diabolically, I mean, you never know.
some feel you have to use a vascularized bone graft. Some feel you absolutely do not. For those that do, there's choices to be made. The one, two, supraretinacular vessel versus the more popular recent medial femoral condyle, free. Not flap, right? No, free flap, right? I forget the terminology.
It's a
Vascularized
flat,
bone graft.
because we don't do
That's exactly right. So, Chris, I'll say this strongly. I much prefer going dorsally for scaphoids. I think it's less disruptive to normal anatomy. I think it's a simpler approach. I think I can put a much better screw in. For every reason, I like this approach better. So, from the approach standpoint, I'd prefer a proximal pole.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I also like going dorsal. I try to go dorsal every time that I can, and I actually have to convince myself to consider going volar just to make have a balanced opinion on things, because there are some cases where I was like, that's a little too much deformity. So I mean, we're not talking specifically about proximal poles anymore, but a waist fracture, what's your threshold on scaphoid flexion before you'll say, ah, fine, I'll go volar?
Should we back up a step? We have listeners of all different ilks, all different training pathways, and all different, we have therapists and students. So to be very clear, the basic principle which we're alluding to is your screw ideally should be placed so that it is entering from the smaller fragment and will have a good purchase in the larger fragment. Now, sometimes the fragments are relatively equal size, but the reason one goes dorsal with a proximal pole is to assure that you have control of that proximal pole and the screw is going where you need it to go. Likewise, a very distal fracture, you would flip that around and go from volar. So Chris's point is a good one. So, most of us for non-unions that choose to that we were feel we're required to go volar is to correct a deformity, the humpback deformity. And you can do some correcting from dorsal, but to really correct and hold that improved scaphoid alignment, most people feel you have to do something from volar. I don't know what the right answer is, Chris, for the waist fractures and how much humpback is okay before you feel like you have to go volar. But I'm with you. I will maybe skirt the issue as long as my lunate isn't tilted too far dorsally. I might try to treat a waist fracture with mild deformity, I might try to treat it from dorsal.
Yeah, and I mean, a fracture is not the same as a non-union, right? So a fracture that's acute, you still got a chance to, so I think the concern is that if you go dorsal and you're working, if you're dissecting over the waist, you're going to disrupt that very delicate blood supply. I think there are ways in which you can work beyond distal to the blood supply and leave the blood supply intact and manipulate your distal fragment to try to get to pull it up so you can get that distal pull out of flexion. And I've done that with success and been very happy with that because it spares the volar approach. It's much easier to shoot the screw down. In terms of principles, before we get back to the case that we brought up, are you a big, biggest screw down the central axis, or how much are you like, we got to get it perpendicular to the fracture?
Central axis almost always, unless you really have an oblique fracture line that challenges that approach. I think central, meaning screw, meaning the K wire and then the screw is center on a PA and center on a lateral. And I like how you corrected me. An acute fracture may be more amenable for going dorsally with some correction of any type of impending angulation, whereas a non-union, you're less likely to be able to correct that from dorsal and more likely to be required to go volar. I think that's well said. I hope I said it right, just like you said it.
Yeah, no, I think that it'd be very hard to try to get any correction from something that's been, a non-union that flexed down or a malunion or whatever. But these are hard. And, so I guess they're, the way I think about the case that that Jana sent in, there's the proximal pull fragment, then there's this kind of weird occult case that he's describing. So do you have you seen a case that's been CT negative, MRI positive? And do you think that's more of a ligament issue than a proximal pull issue?
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is the, mixed approaches in the literature for the identification of an acute fracture. And so not to get totally on a tangent, but if a patient comes in with radial sided wrist pain with negative x-rays upon presentation and negative x-rays at 2 weeks, then most of us would agree that advanced imaging would make sense unless the patient just wants to consent for a cast. And so do we obtain a CT scan or do we obtain an MRI? And the bottom line is there's not a right or wrong answer. Both can be sensitive, meaning pick up the fracture. Both can be specific, meaning if they call it a fracture, it's really a fracture, but both can miss. And so, I honestly, I get CT scans because they're cheaper and faster and easier to obtain. I think that's probably the same thing here. I'm surprised that a non-union would be missed on CT scan. For me, if it's missed, if it's not seen on a CT scan, it doesn't exist. But I applaud the fact that they went ahead because of continued pain and got the MRI. I believe it's real. I believe it's a proximal pull non-union, especially if the ligament looks good on MRI. But I agree with you. If I open this dorsally to look at it, I would absolutely make sure the ligament looks okay.
Yes, so it's interesting. We disagree. Remember early on, we were told that we don't disagree enough.
Yes.
So I disagree with you. I actually get the MRI at that, when it's not, x-rays are negative, continued pain, and they don't just want to do a cast. Mainly because I like to be able to get that bony edema pattern, that so-called bone bruise, and be able to tell patients, hey, there's a bone bruise here, it's not a fracture. I like having that for counseling. Admittedly, you could say you could manage both the same way, but I think for a patient who is x-ray negative, still having pain, but is MRI negative, that comes back, that's good enough for me to say, look, we can go about this two ways. We can either continue to immobilize you, or we can let you kind of work through this pain with a brace and take it off whenever you want and know that it's likely going to be okay. And I know what you're saying about, the sensitivities not being perfect for either study. And I guess I'm wasting healthcare dollars in the US by getting all these MRIs. Doesn't come up that often, but I also remember the utility of the offering a cast. There are some patients that just want to not deal with it. And you taught me that one.
Yeah. Clearly, I didn't teach you everything I should have. The CT scan is clearly the better choice. I'm sorry you're picking MRI here. I'm sorry you don't care about our Medicare debt and the fact that the bank's going to be empty in 2028 here in the U.S. I have absolutely zero problem with getting the MRI. And I think you're right. The beauty of that MRI in the acute setting is the edema pattern. And that is really valuable, especially, and you're right. If you want me to be totally honest, in certain patients, I will get the MRI, and professional athletes would be one of them.
Well, you can always print more money for our healthcare system, right?
Yeah, sure.
That why don't like putting more money into an economy always works. So anyway,
so yes. You do. So I want to share an article about this, which I found very interesting. It's Journal of Hand Surgery European, 2018. So this is not new work. I admit that it wasn't at the tip of my tongue, but it was published. First author is Ramsey. Senior listed author is Scott Wolf from HSS, and it's by the Scaphoid Non-Union Consortium. Sounds a little ominous. And basically, they used a prospective longitudinal registry with 35 scaphoid non-unions. These were not necessarily proximal pole. All were treated with curettage, non-vascularized autogenous grafting, and headless screw fixation. Some did have ischemia. 28 of 33 were found to have impaired vascularity as assessed by intraoperative bleeding, which I, by the way, don't believe in. And despite all that, 33 of 35 healed by 12 weeks. And that's impressive because 12 weeks is not that long. So A, I didn't know there was a scaphoid non-union consortium. And B, this consortium showed what I believe is that I don't really care about the perceptions of ischemia and bleeding and avascularity. I think in these cases, a screw often works just fine.
Yes. So I remember that paper. I think I was actually up there when some of that was going on. And while I have tremendous respect for my mentor, Dr. Wolf, Scott has been fantastic to me. I personally remember the papers not being received very well, at least when it was presented on the podium at some of the meetings. I think, and I cannot remember the exact paper details off the top of my head. So maybe a little homework assignment for me, but the definition of healing was not uniformly accepted. I will leave it at that.
Yeah. And I get that. You know what? People get upset when they feel dogmatic about something and there's a presentation to the contrary. In that same Journal of Hand Surgery European 2018 edition, there's a good paper out of Chicago. Robert Wysocki is the senior author there with Mark Cohen and John Fernandez and others. And they showed the same thing, that really high rates of healing with non-vascularized cancellous graft for proximal pole non-unions. The point is, it's part of a conversation with a patient, even though ultimately we as the physician have to make this decision. At least in my opinion, I think, you know, if you have a super educated patient in your office, then maybe you get into more details. I typically present options and then guide the patient, as you and I have talked about, where I think this should go. But I don't know. How do you handle these situations? What would you tell this patient and how would you manage her 1-year-old fracture, recently identified proximal pole non-union?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's enough evidence. I mean, so this has not had a chance to heal because it hasn't had stability. So it's not, you know, like you're biologically, you've already tried some stability and that's not working and you're clearly dealing with a blood flow issue. Now, this is obviously the worst part of the scaphoid to deal with, just given that it's the furthest away from the blood supply. But I think giving it a chance at fixation is a very reasonable thing. I probably would go to non-vascularized. The only thing that gives me pause is that if this doesn't work, then what am I going to do? Have I left enough options for my partners who are, the microvascular surgeons? So, you know, honestly, I probably would tell the patient that I'm going to talk about it with a partner and, you know, here's what I would do, but I want to talk to somebody who would be the person to take care of you after if this didn't work. And I would phone my friend, David Bruggen, who is a fantastic microsurgeon, and ask him his thoughts. And he always volunteers to see them because he's great like that. But, you know, at the very least, I want his thoughts.
I appreciate that. I mean, he certainly has, as we all do, his set of biases, and he's a big fan of the medial femoral condyle. I get that. I will do the one too, because it's local, because it's straightforward, and because there are good results in the literature. But I will not go to the mat for that operation. I just sometimes question how much vascularity I'm truly bringing. I question whether I'm just creating scar tissue. But I don't think it's an unreasonable option in the right patient.
Is fragment excision an option here? That was brought up in the email from Giannis.
Not for me, because I don't think you can take out a fragment. This isn't so. There are the super proximal poles, and there are the small proximal poles, and there's just a proximal pole. And that super clearly, everyone knows what I'm talking about. The super proximal pole is when it's really just a sliver, mainly the cartilage at the insertion of the scapulanate ligament. Those are just really hard because there's no expectation of healing because there's no real bone on the fragment. This is a fragment that has bone. I think you have to fix it, and I think you can expect it will heal. I think if you try to take this out, you will create a problem because there's simply the ligament won't have enough surface area to attach to.
So say you're bringing in your 1-2. Or you're not going to the mat for it and you're doing some kind of cancellous grafting. How do you fix it? How do you do the carpentry on this one? For some of the more sizable proximal pole fragments, I know there's some literature out of New York, and I think it was combined maybe with Seattle, looking at their experience using very small headless compression screws in tandem, usually 1 or 2. What are your thoughts on that technique, or what would you do in terms of fixation?
So it really does get down to the size of the fragment, but I should say strongly that I'm a Joe Slade disciple. And Joe Slade taught us that one could approach these fractures from dorsally. And initially it was advocated that it'd be percutaneous. I don't believe in percutaneous because I don't like to wrap up all the soft tissues and tendons in the area, but very small incision. And I place my K-wire. And if I think it's large enough for a mini Accutrac, then that's what I'll drill for. And I think that's a 2.5 drill bit for a 3.0 screw. I get those confused.
I think it's 2.5, 2.8 in terms of the threads on the tail versus the leading.
Okay. So K-wire, and then I drill, and then I use cancellous bone graft harvested from the same incision, Lister tubercle or wherever. I pack it down the drill hole. I don't disrupt the cartilage, and the cartilage in these cases always looks normal. So if you're going to truly open the fracture, you're going to create a lot more instability, so to speak. So I leave that alone, just drill, bone graft in the drill hole, place my screw. If it's not big enough for the mini and you're thinking about a micro or 2 micros, either do the same thing and just try to place bone graft down the smaller screw holes, or you can create a little window. I'm not a huge fan of creating a window through the cartilage to bone graft, but I do sometimes use those micro screws. And I think there's a great role. There's still nice compression achieved. I do like the concept of placing 2, but sometimes 1's all you get. Now, if you only get 1, again, going back to what Joe Slade taught us, you can also decrease the forces across the scaphoid by placing something distally. And I will often use a 6-2 K-wire from the distal scaphoid into the capitate to decrease that lever arm of forces. Some have advocated putting a screw, putting an Accutrac from scaphoid to the capitate and take it out 6 or 8 weeks later. I like a K-wire and I leave it proud and take it out the 6 or 8 weeks. And I've been happy with that approach. I think it makes some sense.
So is that like a scapha capitate razzle almost?
It would be. It would be with planned removal.
Of course, you got to put the plan removal in there, but that's intense. But, for those that are wondering why put the pin across the SC, your scaphoid is going to want to flex if you don't have a lot of stability proximally. So you want to stop the scaphoid from flexing. So you've got the pin across the scapha capitate joint to hold that in place. I find that really interesting. I think that these can be really super, super challenging. The carpentry is really, really important. Is this somebody that you're going to immobilize until off the bat for 10 to 12 weeks? And how are you monitoring healing?
So that's a great point. And, it's interesting what I remember from my mentors, some things that, granted, I don't think I've ever said that someone's going to remember 10 years later, but there are some things that Dr. Mansky would say about congenital or Dr. Gelberman would say about different topics. And I will never forget Dr. Gelberman. It was never just a statement. It was always a pimp question that was full expectation that the answer would be correct. But proximal poles take forever to heal. An average healing time for a proximal pole non-union is 12 to 14 weeks. That is a long time. And so my general strategy, and I'd love to hear yours, my general strategy doesn't change for these fractures. It is 6 weeks post-operative immobilization and a thumb spica IP free. And it's 6 weeks I get them out, assuming I have some trust in the patient. And that does not always exist, that trust. But if I do trust them, they go into a removable brace. They can shower. They can do some gentle wrist motion if there's no scaphocapitate pin, but nothing passive, nothing aggressive, and splint to be worn essentially 24/7. And then I consider a CT scan at 8 to 10 weeks to give me an update, especially when the x-rays are inconclusive, which they always are. How does your strategy differ?
Not terribly different. I remember being on the receiving end of that PIP question. So that's always fun. I was actually telling some Dr. Gelberman stories in the OR yesterday because his longtime scrub Nancy had come in to relieve my scrub tech when I was doing a case down there. And so we were having a good time. And so my protocol doesn't differ very much. I like the CT scan. I don't always agree with how the radiologists interpret it in terms of quantification of healing. But I think it's an important thing to have. It is important to pay attention to the radiologist read because that's what patients get and that's what they see. They get it in the mail or they used to, and now they get it in the portal. So if you have a disagreement with the radiology read, it's important to let the patient know about that. Usually I use point tenderness. This is obviously an area that's difficult to assess true point tenderness on. So that's, you know, one less thing that you can use, but I still try for it. Otherwise protocol doesn't really differ from what you said.
Yeah. Great case. I think we can do well with these. I really do. I expect them to heal as long as we are patient enough and the patient can be patient enough. So I love the case and I hope we learn the outcome from all the way from our friends in Greece.
Yes, please share. Please share. And just to follow up on what you just said, I agree. Setting the stage in terms of expectations of how long it's going to take to heal and what the postoperative course is going to look like and how much consternation you may feel about this particular diagnosis is important. You don't want to scare them, but you want to set realistic expectations and then look like a hero at the end.
Absolutely. You're playing hero ball again. I would like to close by saying I moved my office. I am back in the adult world. At our main office. And I have to say, so I moved my office 7 years ago to go over to Children's Hospital. And then I moved back to the adult office space. It is amazing how much crap one accumulates in 7 years. And it was absolutely fantastic to liberate myself from some of the crap that I accumulated. But one of my favorite things, I came across my file of grateful patient notes. And these handwritten notes still happen and I still save them. And I even print them out if I happen to get email, but most of the time they're handwritten. And it's kind of like the nice things people say about the podcast, which gives us fuel. Though that file of cards is, it's gold. And I am so grateful.
Yeah. You know, we stopped doing our win of the week segment. And thank you for reminding me of that. And on a related note, so first off, it's great to have you back in the IOH. And the reason is not because you were fired as chief of PEDS, but because the role was taken over by one of our hand surgery partners, Dr. Lindley Wall, is following your footsteps and being chief of pediatric orthopedics for our department. So congratulations to her.
Yeah, and she's going to be fantastic. We had a nationwide search. I think we are all happy that Lindley accepted this position and she will do great things at Children's. She'll still be a hand surgeon, but she's going to be, she's transitioning to just being a hand surgeon, for kids, maybe a little liberal definition of kids, and it needs to transition because she don't want to just abandon her patients, but it's great. I'm so excited for her.
And so that brings me to the reason why I thought about the gratitude thing that you mentioned is I actually have a gratitude folder in my Outlook inbox. So my fantastic research coordinator, Carrie Burke, was saying some very nice things about some patient interactions recently. And I just kept dropping those emails into the gratitude folder. And that is, you know, my virtual way of keeping track of some things that make me very happy. And then I still have, like you do, the folder in the office of patient notes, and that is the best. I mean, it's why we do it. To anybody listening, I know many of you probably already do this. Therapists, surgeons, trainees, it is the best to do something like that.
I have to say, full disclosure, I struggle a little bit more with the either single, like poster size framed patient photos. And sometimes I get collages, which are really cool, but then I just don't know what to do with them after, you know, a while. Those are super thoughtful as well, but they don't store quite as easily as a nice card.
I'm waiting for the Goldfarb microfiche collection of gratitude.
All right, man. It's great spending late on a Thursday night with you. It's good to see you.
Pleasure is mine. Look forward to our next recording. Everybody have a wonderful week.
Absolutely. Thank you. Happy Bastille Day, by the way.
That's not an American holiday, right? That's a French holiday.
It's a reason to celebrate.
I do love French pastries, so I will go eat some.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.